Hello guys, and welcome to our workshop. I think this will be way less formal than yesterday. So we'll have a chat together. We will go over some stuff we prepared. We wanted actually to enable our camera, but our Wi-Fi connection on this device is kind of poor. So don't want to risk it now to drop out. So we probably will just leave it turned off. Do you want to wait for Jason?
I don't know. I presumably he's just getting out of his talk now.
So for the...
Oh, Rob is asking. He's here already.
For the structure of this workshop, we thought that we will probably go through the algorithm again, this time a bit more slowly or in the speed that everyone can follow it, and we can also see if there are questions, if we skimmed through something too quickly yesterday. You can ask questions all the time. Then we will probably...
We'll talk about a few other bits and pieces that we didn't get to talk about that are kind of relevant for ICO and IR3. And if there was any questions from the IR3 register allocation review that people still didn't understand, we can also go through the code and probably for ICO too. We have, I think Daniel has the code open here. So the reason I originally did this talk was that that I originally wanted to do this talk was that people were asking me on when reviewing the IR3 register allocator, like, hey, do you have any resources that explain the basics of this, like any overview? And there's all of the existing resources are started off with like, oh, this is the definition of a chordal graph, and this is a perfect coloring, and then hand waved away all the live ring splitting, the details of live ring splitting. So I hope that this will be useful. And so if there's something that can be done more effectively in person than in code review, which is always a little tougher for big complicated things, then we can also do that here.
And then we can also lose a few words on register allocation validation. And eventually maybe present even a path towards SSA-based register allocation without doing it directly on SSA. If you understand the theory behind it, then you might already figure there is a way to do this SSA-based register allocation style on after translating out of SSA. We will maybe briefly talk about it just to give the opportunity if you're interested to in converting an existing register data to be able to do that. Please let us know if our connection gets bad, because I already see the red light there. Or if you don't understand anything, you can also at any time basically unmute yourself and ask a question. Otherwise, I think we just jump into it.
Should we wait for Jason? Because he said he was interested.
Sorry, I didn't get that.
I was just asking, should we wait for Jason?
I think he's doing his own breakout on ray tracing, which is a little sad because I know he really wanted to be in here.
It's not right now. He just finished his talk like a couple of minutes ago, I think.
Yeah, I think he's going to put one together, but later.
Oh, okay, later. I misread that then. Okay.
He just joined. Hi, Jason.
What am I putting together later?
We were more on the introduction, so you didn't really miss anything.
Okay.
So the idea is that we go over the algorithm once again, more slowly, and to allow asking questions and see if everything is clear. So
let's skip the SSA form stuff.
Yeah, I think
skip the background.
I hope SSA is clear for everyone. And also the deconstruction, I assume that it's pretty clear. You have to insert copies at the control flow edges. Also register location itself should be a topic that is clear, and
all
the idea why.
Okay, yeah, so let's start here, I guess.
Pieces.
Yeah, so hopefully the kill flags thing is pretty clear. The way the actual algorithm works is very simple. You just walk backwards and keeping track of what's live, and then the first time something pops up while walking backwards, you add the kill flag to it. That was one of the most straightforward parts when I was implementing it. Didn't even bother looking at what echo did because it seemed pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it just indicates that the variable is no longer used after this moment.
The only reason I really put it in here is an important data structure wise, like, you know, what actual data structure you use. So it's kind of different from, for example, linear scan, where you keep track of the ranges instead. And then this is like the core algorithm that stays the same pretty much throughout the entire thing, although it gets kind of wonky as soon as you start to do live range splitting. The whole idea of like having this register file, and for each register keeping track of whether it's available or in use by some value is kind of the core idea here. And that gets way more complicated and tricky as you add more and more stuff on top of it. But the basic idea stays the same. Just add kill flags. Use the kill flags to figure out if you need to remove it from the file, and then pick something from the available things. And all of the secret sauce, all the hard parts, is going to be put in pick fizzard, which thinking now, I should have called it get reg, because that's what echo and IR3 call it. That's kind of a mistake, but whatever.
Yeah, so for the actual algorithm to pick a physical register, there's plenty of choices. For example, we use in echo, we use best fit at the moment. And in IR3, they use some round robin to figure the register, which is likely a good fit.
Yeah, it works better because we have these knobs. Unlike in the RDNA 2, unlike in the original AMD instruction, there's a delay between writing and reading a register.
So pipeline stalls.
So the round robin does a really good job at avoiding that. I know in the graph calling algorithm that was originally proposed, the round robin, but round robin actually does even better with this, because rather than doing round robin on some random order picked by the core graph calling algorithm, you're doing round robin on the actual source code order, which is what you really want. So when I did that, it went from being net negative in terms of knobs into net positive.
So are there questions up to this point?
Hi, it's Tim Renouf here. I was just wondering about the round robin thing, because something that was pointed out in one of the papers about this is that round robin gives you a chance to do better in post RA scheduling. Does ACO do any post RA scheduling that could take advantage of that?
Not yet. Yeah, but IR3 does. It does do post RA scheduling, and like I said, doing a round robin made it dramatically better. So I started out with the best fit because I was just copying from ACO, and then IR3, and then I changed it to round robin once I got the register presser estimation working, and then that improved the quality of post RA scheduling dramatically from worse than the original, which was doing round robin but on graph coloring, to even better than the original. Which I'm hypothesizing is because I'm doing round robin in the source code order, which is going to be better.
Yeah. And I take your point about on RDNA that you have those pipelines installed, so round robin helps you on that as well.
Yeah. I think Echo, Timur is working on the post RA scheduler.
Yeah, Timur wrote some post RA scheduler that's a bit work in progress and needs more refinement and stuff, but we will definitely look into that again. And then we might also switch to round robin, but
By the way, what's your IRC nickname? Because I would be interested in talking to you about your post RA scheduler.
Then let's look into handling control flow, because here stuff gets more interesting.
I assume most people know the classic data flow algorithm. Something you can find online, described many different sources, and it's just the data structure there is just the live in and live out bit set. I think that's how both Echo and IR3 handle it. And in addition, you have these kill flags. So now you do the same like dance of walking backwards, but start out with the live out set instead of with nothing.
Also keep in mind that now a variable can have multiple kill flags in different blocks. Like it can be killed once in the then branch leg, and then it can be killed again in the else branch leg.
And in a loop, it's important to note that a variable can have no kill flag at all, and it can just be killed in the end of the loop, kind of. If a variable is defined outside of the loop and then used inside the loop. Dominance, hopefully everyone, since we kind of assume you know SSA.
So can you? Going back to liveness and kill flags, maybe you said this and I missed it, but how do you handle the weirdness around disabled channels for, say, SGPOs?
SGPOs don't have disabled channels. That's the thing.
You stuff that's alive, even if it's not, like, it's alive in portions of the IR where if you just look at the classic, like, node-based control flow graph, it looks dead.
So the way Echo handles that, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so in Echo, we have a linear and a logical control flow graph. So we clearly we basically do two different sets of live in and live out variables. Once that and the uniform values basically follow the linear control flow graph, and the live in and live out sets are along the edges of the linear control flow graph, and the BGPRs are handled along the logical control flow graph, and so
fee nodes and stuff, for example, might have different numbers of arguments depending upon their whether it's like a logical fee or a linear fee.
So the second point, I think, Connor can, I think, better talk about if you have implicit control flow instructions. So not having this linear control flow graph and still be able to,
That's a bit tricky. I don't remember exactly how it works on Intel, but I remember if you watch the talk a bit later, I mentioned how because these fee nodes are supposed to happen along the control flow edge, if you have a critical edge, then it becomes a problem. Because you can't insert the fixer code, and so you need to insert a block along that edge. But the problem is that these like linear edges that you add to model the like the what the machine actually does. Well, those are critical edges. So if you just add the edge from the if to the else in your simple if else, then it's going to be a critical edge. And in ACO, they can kind of get around that. And there's a nice graph that you'll try to find again because you have the hardware has complete control. You have complete control over the hardware. So you just go and insert a bunch of empty blocks.
Yeah.
And then you get a picture like this.
Yeah, so what you can see here is that divergent branching in ACO is actually done as two branches, one for the else, and we remove both critical edges by inserting like linear extra blocks.
And those linear blocks don't actually correspond to anything in the original shader. They're just there in case, the invert thing inverts the exact mask, but the then and else linear blocks are just there to insert any extra, to hold any extra copies you might need to generate in RA if there are vnodes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So if it's possible, like the way with implicit control flow, you only have the bottom picture. So if you can insert, so that on the bottom picture with the logical then and else, the linear edge is just a single edge from the then to the else, which is then a critical edge. So if you can somehow insert a basic block between them, which is basically would be with like no mask enabled, with nothing enabled before turning off the exec mask and then before turning it on for the else, then you can get around that problem. But otherwise, you have to, I don't know, resort to some hacks.
There actually is some hack possible, and we can get to that later, I think.
Yeah, the hack I did for IR3.
So, or just to phrase the idea quickly, it's that you copy back the uniform values to their original position if you had a life range split within the branch.
Within the then.
And there's
the then branch.
Yeah, and there's some theory behind it that it's always possible. Yeah, but we can also discuss that a bit later, I think, and continue on the algorithm.
Okay. Yeah, for us, unfortunately, we don't have a clean split between SGPO and VGPO unless we went out of our way to artificially create one.
Yeah, so you would probably need to split liveness into two bits, which you probably already do, I imagine. Like, whether something is live in the active lanes versus whether it's only live in the inactive lanes. The problem is that if something is live with only the inactive lanes, multiple things can be sharing the same register. So things get a bit hairy.
Yeah. And the other thing is that we can have even logical things that still interfere in the physical control flow graph because we don't have, because of the crazy striding stuff that we do, if you have, say, a 32-bit thing and a 16-bit thing, they may actually have different sets of channels overlapping.
Right. So then in that case,
sort of physical.
I guess what you have to do is somehow keep track of at each point for each VEC8, like what the channel stride is, whether it's not being used by anything, it is being used by an inactive thing, and the channel stride is X, and you may only use the X for active things, or live.
Figuring out the liveness isn't too bad, and I've gone about like some approaches where we keep track of strides and we try to match similarly strided things on top of each other. And it works for the purposes of interference, but when I'm thinking about how to deal with like fee node resolution and where do you place the fee nodes, what happens if you move one of those things, I don't have a good idea how to do that yet. Most GPUs have VGPRs that cannot interfere across channels really, really helps with that problem.
And then you can add a few hacks for the remaining scenarios, like subgroup operations where you do have that, but
example sort of assumes like a uniform register file if you have available registers and you're doling them out, but does that work when you have SGPRs and VGPRs? Are those just two sets of registers? How does that work for like half floats versus doubles?
For SGPRs and VGPRs, it's very simple. You just keep track of the SGPR pressure and the VGPR pressure. They're just two separate register files, and you can pretty easily extend this. So instead of a single available set, you have like a available set per register file. That's actually the easy part. Versus the doubles thing and whatnot, that's where live range splitting comes in, which is the next part of the talk.
So there's a clear distinction. So doubles are basically vector registers, at least for Radian, because they just occupy two registers. For half loads, that's a bit more tricky because they occupy half a register. And then is the question, what about the other half? Do we pretend that it's actually that it needs the full register, or do we want to reuse that for something else? We basically wrote a hack on top of our register allocator to handle that, but the different idea would be to just use it per byte, your register file, or there's different solutions. So in the end, I think that's more an implementation detail than actually something affecting the general idea or something. Yeah. We can have a look at the what comes next. So dominance, we already talked about that. Basically, in source code order in an SSA, you have dominance properties satisfied. And here we see that you can get these two kill flags on the in the then branch lag and also in the else branch lag.
I think in this one, it's used in a loop, so it doesn't even have a kill flag at all, which is kind of what I was mentioning.
No, then you would have no kill flag in the then branch either.
I was going for the two scenarios of like it can have a kill flag or it can just be killed at the end of the loop.
Yeah, either way.
And then I went over the proof of correctness of this like dominance order thing pretty quickly. So if anyone has any questions, and this is kind of the key part of like why it's called tree scan, like why this like works at all and doesn't blow up in your face. So if anyone has any questions about that, about like why it's correct and why we get, why when we visit the beginning of the block, everything is already in a separate register and already visited.
I think so the key point to take away is that at the beginning of each block, you iterate all live in variables and fill your register file with where the variables already are. And there's only two ways how you can have incoming variables in your register file at the beginning of the block. And that's either they are live in, that means they are live out at the a media dominator, or they are from a fee node. So it's only these two options. And the live ins already have a register, and that's the same register no matter from which path the control flow comes. And then there's the fee nodes, and these variables can be in different registers depending on the control flow graph, depending on the control the path takes. So
oh, and one thing I think I forgot to mention, I'm just thinking about this now. The reason, so this algorithm, actually, we didn't even treat fee nodes as special at all in here, and it still works. And the reason why is that we treat fee nodes, you have to treat fee nodes as special in the liveness analysis pass, because you have to treat fee node sources, again, as being read at the end of the predecessor block. And then they sort of kill or they can, anyways, kill that value. And you have to be a bit careful about that.
Yeah, so what happens is that you actually just pick any free register for your fee nodes, and then hope that your sources, the sources of the fee node, have the same register. That means that you get away without any copying of registers. It's just, then it's already there in the correct register. Or if you're not so lucky, then your sources of the fee node have a different register than the destination. And this means you have to implement a copy from one register to the other register in the predecessor or along the edge from the predecessor block.
Oh, and one thing I forgot to mention, the fee nodes are not special at all in this, but once you start to do live rank splitting, then fee nodes do have to become special because you don't insert parallel copies. You can't insert parallel copies before them. They have to stay at the beginning, and you kind of have to allocate them all in parallel. So you can do basically the same shuffle code, but then the shuffles are basically free, not really free because you might have to insert more copies for the fees, but you basically just ignore it. And then at the very end, you have the initial state of the register file, including all of the fee nodes and all of the live ins, and then you just go and assign the destinations for fee nodes all at once.
Are there questions about this part? I hope we didn't explain it too confusing.
Yeah.
Did we drop or no? Okay, that sounds like nobody understood.
Either everyone understood everything or no one understood anything, and it's usually the second one.
You really have to tell if that's unclear.
Yeah, because there's no, we can't really read the room, so there's no way to look and see if everyone is totally lost.
I'm still good.
Cool. So here's then we had this example about the fee nodes. This was with swapping. So Connor said that fee nodes happen in parallel. This does not mean that you have to allocate the registers in parallel. You can just pick one by one. Keep in mind that live range splits there, if these need to happen, then they are a bit more complicated. But the idea of how a fee node is executed, so to speak, is that they happen in parallel. So if you assign them the registers, like in this example, there you can see that E1 gets register 0 and the C gets R1. And this is, like already kind of said in the presentation, it's fine for the then branch because you can see on both fee nodes that from the if, they also, A comes from R0 and D comes from R1. So there's no copy needed. The incoming value is already in the correct register. but coming from the L side, the E0 value resides in R1 and the A value resides in R0. So they are in the wrong registers and need to be copied to the destination of the fee. And this has to happen in parallel, because all the fee nodes are basically executed in parallel, or the values are read in parallel. So in this case, we have to copy R1 to R0 and R0 to R1, and this needs a swap.
Yeah, and I think the reason I chose this example is that if you like work at it with paper and pencil, you can kind of see that it's actually impossible to allocate this program without swaps using only two registers. So this whole like fee nodes execute in parallel is not just like a thing we made up. It's kind of what makes the whole thing possible in a way.
And let me tell you, so much it actually happens in practice. I don't know why, but some people like to program like that. So it really occurs in practical shaders. And but also this can happen on accident. So the big difference between SSA-based register allocation and the classical register allocation is that you don't really know in advance which variables should go into the same register. So in the classical register allocation approach, there is like the E1 would be the same variable written in the then and in the else branch, and C would be the same variable and not three different ones. So it's clear that they kind of must get the same register. On SSA-based register allocation, you don't know that, and your register allocator just has to try to give them the same register. But if you want to make this perfectly, you are definitely in an NP-hard terrain. And if you do that heuristically, you might end up with just bad luck and need to insert swaps and a few copies more. So if you have a swap instruction in your architecture, that's cool. And if you don't, then well,
sorry.
You basically end up with, if you only swap two instructions, that's the same amount as you need if you have an extra register, right? Then you also need three instructions.
Yeah.
And if you have chains of swap cycles, then an extra register would be good. I mean, you can, it depends on how advanced you make the register locator. You can check if there's a free register available and hand this over and try to use that to resolve these cycles. And this brings us to the resolving of the fee nodes.
Yeah, so that this slide was more of a, rather than examples, like how to do it in general. And I really sped over this because I thought we would run out of time, even though we actually didn't kind of wound up early. So here is a place that if anyone wants to know like more about the details of the algorithm, they can ask away. It's again very similar to the like from SSA and NER.
I wonder if this is actually also an NP-hard problem, but you always have this very short number of
I don't think
copies.
It's, I think the simple version is an NP complete. Like, I think you can prove that the version in that paper gives you the minimum number of copies.
But is this linear?
Linear time?
Yeah.
Yeah, the algorithm in the Bossino paper.
Yeah, true.
I think that part isn't the hard part. But the funny thing is that in practice, this algorithm, can become really complicated because right now I'm just talking about the simple case, but in the more complicated case where you have different kinds of registers and whatnot, it turns out to be a good idea to just have a parallel copy instruction that can basically copy anything to anything. And that simplifies a bunch of other parts of the compiler. And then you can put all the complexities about like which instruction do I use, which weird swizzle do I use, and so on, into this pass. And you can use it for fee nodes. I think later I mentioned you can use it for splits and collects. And the parallel copies you create with live brain splitting. So it's really versatile and allows you to put all of those fiddly like copy details into one pass. So,
but the general idea is that you have a bunch of copies that need to happen in parallel in the semantics, and you try to find a sequence of instructions which has the exact same semantics as if it happens in parallel. So yeah, you can quickly think about that. It's fairly straightforward that you have to follow an order how to copy one register to the other so that you never overwrite something that you still need. So that's the idea. And you might end up with a cycle at the end or with multiple cycles, and then these cycles are a series of swap instructions or XORs. We also have the statement here that you need to consider affinities. That is, that
I think we
just
touched on that before.
Yeah,
right?
we already touched on that. So it's best if you avoid if the fee destination is a different register than the sources, then you don't need a copy at all because the value already is in the correct register. So that's all this affinity stuff about. And you can try to make it basically infinitely smart in your register locator to try to always match the fee sources with the destination. But it will still not always work out.
So yeah, in a traditional graph coloring register allocator, the hill you die on, the thing that kind of always sucks is you just pick the wrong like allocation order, and then you just run out of the registers. And then that always winds up being a problem, and you have tons of heuristics to sort of tune that and so on. And you try and fix that and try to do live brain splitting, and then here the problem becomes, oh my God, we're inserting too many copies. Why?
Yeah, I just on Monday, I created a merge request that does tune the affinities on the echo slightly. And I think it removes like 2% of all copy instructions. Or that's very sensitive in the register locator, how you handle affinities and this kind of stuff. It has a really big impact on the final outcome. That brings us to live brain splitting. Live brain splitting basically is the solution to all constraints, all assumptions. It resolves all assumptions that were taken in the previous papers about SSI-based register allocation, where they assume that every variable has a size of one. So, and there's no pre-coloring and no whatsoever, and every instruction can use the same registers and stuff like that. And the live range splitting basically helps to resolve all these issues, I think. Yeah. All. So if you have pre-coloring, you can resolve that with live range splits. If you have vectors, you can resolve it with that. So yeah, it's the hammer to solve to make it fit.
It's the hammer we have, and then everything kind of looks like a nail. This was also one of the main reasons I wanted to do this talk, because again, if someone asks, like, well, is there an overview on how live range splitting works in ACO and IR3? Again, the answer is no. So all the papers on SSA-based register allocation just kind of hand wave their way around this and say stuff like, just insert a parallel copy instruction for every live value in between every instruction, and then the graph is portal again. And you're like, but that would kill performance.
Yeah, I think there's actually, I only remember one paper which does a live range splitting algorithm. That's the puzzle solving paper from Fernando Pereira. And he assumes that every vector is a power of 2 in size, and that simplifies stuff a lot. It simplifies stuff so much that we just cannot use it. As soon as you have VEC3 or you have unaligned or both vectors, then it all falls apart and you have to figure, like,
it's probably MP hard as soon as you add those in.
Yeah.
So how much the minimum splitting problem.
I mean, I hope the example is more or less clear that you might end up in a situation where there is enough space in the register file, but not for your variable.
Not contiguous.
Yeah, not contiguous, it's scattered, and you have to make space that is contiguous. So
yeah, it's like the fragmentation in like a memory allocator or something like that, except that here we have the tools to actually move things around and fix it, the fragmentation kind of.
Yeah, and in this example here, we just move the one register away, and then we have enough space. But there is this worst case scenario, and I only want to mention it briefly here. Here in this example, we just have one free register at the beginning, one at the end, and in between we have only VEC2, so we cannot move a single variable away to make space. We would actually have to move every single variable that is in the register file. And just for how probable is this even? And I can tell you that in echo, this happens exactly once in the whole CTS that a bit tries to force this scenario by loading a bunch of VEC3, I think, like the whole register file is full of that. And that's the only situation where we ever needed that. And to fix our broken CTS test, Reese implemented a small algorithm that just moves every variable to the beginning of the register file. But that's really such a worst case scenario. You will likely never encounter this in any real world application ever.
Go ahead. I'll let you finish what you're saying, then I have two questions.
Sure.
Yeah. What were you going to say?
Just that this likely never happened. Did I want to add more? I don't think so.
Okay.
It was done.
Okay. So first question, have you experimented with artificially slightly decreasing the size of your register file to make this less likely?
To make it less likely, you mean like overestimating the number of variables we need?
Yeah, by like one register or something to give you just
So echo does kind of do that where, well, it does it on the fly. So like rather when they have a sort of clever recursive algorithm that tries to use less moves, and when that fails, rather than doing this, shuffle everything, they just bump up the size of the register file because of the whole dynamic register sharing thing.
So first,
does that have any interaction with the occupancy cliff edges? You know, it seems to me that there's no point trying to allocate into 62 registers because 64 gives you the same occupancy. So you would kind of round up anyway, wouldn't you?
If you're near the edge, then you just have to suck it up and just move everything, because this whole point of this, like SSA-based register allocation, is that you don't have to spill. But fortunately, so if you it is kind of unfortunate if you're on the edge and then you just kind of have to move up. But yeah, so in ACO and IR3, the way it works is that we calculate the register pressure, and then from the register pressure, we calculate the demand that's possible, assuming that we just allocate everything as tightly as possible. And then from that, we go and calculate the real register pressure. So we do this kind of thing you mentioned where, like, if we can bump up the demand by a few extra registers to have the same occupancy, then we will do that. So this case doesn't come up unless your register pressure happens to be exactly at that limit, usually.
It would be interesting to figure if you can calculate a minimum number of extra registers you need to never get into this situation, or if this is possible. I think this will be either too large to be feasible, or it just doesn't work out. But another thing to note is that in real world applications, you always have enough single scalar variables next to each other that you can always move these scalar variables into empty slots and have space. So the practical worst case is that you have to move size of your vector variables. Yeah. That's what happens in practice.
And the other thing to note is that most of the time in the backend, you are immediately creating a vector when you need to, let's say, have a texture instruction, you just create a vector immediately before it, and then in a load instruction, you split the vector immediately after in instruction selection, typically, and then if you keep that around, if you keep that split vector and create vector around, then the amount of time when there's a vector register in the file is very, very small. This only really becomes a problem when your pre-RA scheduler moves things around, or when you optimize like a split and then collect into a single, into the original thing. Which I think ACO does that for other reasons, which is maybe why you ran into this problem in the first place. It kind of sucks because if your pre-RA scheduler does that, and if you don't have this optimization of detecting a split and then a collect and then just returning the original vector, then you're never going to have more than one or two live vectors at the same time. And then you pretty much never run into this in practice. But there's no way in theory to go through your entire allocator and your entire backend and just prove that this will never happen.
Our scheduler has some, can create some entertaining shaders sometimes. Create the payloads for 16 texture instructions and then fire the texture instructions.
Yeah, so that's exactly the scenario where this kind of becomes an issue.
So the other question that I was going to ask is, have you considered, am I still here?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, I just, my display blanked, and so I don't know what happened. Have you considered, if you hit this scenario, instead just move the first component of V0 out of the way?
I actually started out the IR3 register allocator assuming that I would do this, and then it became a giant mess. Because I started around the time I started it, Riz was implementing this special case, and I was like, I can just avoid it, right? The problem is that the data structure then becomes way, way more complicated, because consider that instructions can have multiple vector sources, and then those sources all have to be aligned. So your texture instruction or a store instruction that takes both a descriptor and a vector value, for example, on AMD or something like that. So you still kind of have this problem because let's say you coalesce the first source and then yay, you can just move whatever components, you don't have to care about this. But then once you've coalesced it, it's there and you can't break it up again in order to coalesce the second source. And when you allocate the destination, you also can't uncoalesce those sources. So again, it's this case where like you in theory don't need the backup, but how the hell are you gonna actually prove that like whatever heuristic you came up with like actually does this successfully?
Yeah, because you have, at least on our hardware, you have potentially three vectors that all have to be vectors at the time the instruction executes, because some sends can have two vector sources and a vector destination. So yeah, that makes sense. I just, like, when I was looking at this, it's like, okay, there's an obvious solution to this. I'm sure there's a reason they're not doing this. What it is.
I tried real hard.
Yeah. We also discussed this like several times and gave up on it. But it's so unlike, or it's so rare, that I think it's not really worth the time that you spend on it to improve this one edge case that actually never happens.
So you implement this kind of shitty algorithm and then at least you sleep soundly at night that your register allocator won't fall apart.
And you pass the CTS.
And you pass the CTS.
So the code you compile, presumably it never has calls in.
It never has calls. We haven't implemented shader calls, yeah, but that's basically the same sort of shenanigans.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
So when Daniel mentioned never having pre-colored registers, again, this is the solution. This is the hammer for your nail.
Yeah. But with the calls thing, is there a... Not with the fragmentation thing you're talking about here with the vectors, but with the call thing, is there some scope to kind of bias your register allocation to try and avoid the situation happening and avoid?
Yeah, so it would be similar to the affinities, the phi affinities probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. We also use some kind of affinities for our VEC3, VEC4 and such instructions. So if we know that we will use these components later in a vector, we already try when assigning the register for the variables, we already try to align them next to each other so that we don't get overhead when we are at the actual create vector instruction. And something similar would be done if you want to call arguments in specific registers that you already try to use these register when the destination is written. So that's part of the heuristic to improve or to have less copies than in general.
And another thing to note is that it's actually impossible, or it can become impossible if you want to have fixed registers that don't start at the beginning. Because if it doesn't start at the beginning, like if you try to fix R1, R2, and R3, well, what if the rest of your register file, what if the rest of the live values happen to be VEC2s? And then there's like one hole at the beginning and one hole at the end, and then you just can't move it. So you really can't allocate it without spilling. So you have to be kind of careful with dealing with fixed registers.
So yep. I think for us, we have fixed registers at the beginning and we have fixed registers at the end, but the live ranges of the two never overlap.
Yeah.
But at the end is like...
Is that at the send message at the end?
So there's a requirement that the last message that leaves the EU has to be in high registers, or else there's a waste.
Yeah, I think that's pretty easy. We actually have something very similar in IR3 because we have these shader chaining thing where kind of like on AMD, the vertex shader and the escalation control shader are the same thing, but they're actually in separate binaries. The hardware has a magic instruction that one chains to the other, and then there's like an ABI in between them. So like the some special magic control registers have to be in like R0, and then this one has to be in R1. But that's not hard to handle because, first of all, you do the biasing thing that we were talking about of like trying to allocate it in this register at the definition. And then at the very end, well, the only thing that's live is your register. So you can just move it around however you want. And so you can, if you get to that last message and then it just happens to be that it got assigned to the wrong register, well, you can just move it.
Right, that yeah. makes sense.
Yeah, if your register file is empty, then this is not a problem. We can get to the control flow handling with live range splits. That is, what happens if a variable gets split on one path of the control flow and not on another one? So that means that in this example, v1, after executing both branch legs, is when coming from the then branch is in a different register than coming from the else branch. And this is kind of tricky because yeah, you have to repair that. So sorry for the slide. Let's stick with this one. So I think it's obvious that after the branch, you want V1 again to be in the same register, no matter from which path the control flow took. So what Echo in this case does is create a new fee node and assign it, remove it from the live ins, because it's in this case not really a live in variable with one fixed register anymore, but it's like two different values coming from two different paths. So we create a fee node, and this fee node gets a register assigned whatever is available. We try to give it like either R1 or R2 in this case to match at least one of the edges and only have a copy on the other. So one solution is that you insert a copy in the else side to also move it to R2, or in the then branch, like you can just move it back to R1. So, but either of the two have to happen.
And the thing I was mentioning to Daniel is that actually, there are these two approaches that you either you either rename all the SSA values and like keep SSA, or you have the uses of your value have different register than the definition and insert these copies with just physical registers, which is what IR3 does. But even if you do that, you can't just insert a copy at the end of the else branch in this example. Like, it just doesn't work because, and I have like a whole long comment and IR3 explaining this, but that copy has to happen in parallel with copies for fee nodes, because fee nodes, again, the sources are considered to be live. So we need to swap a fee node source. And so if we wanna say, let's say we wanna move R2 back to R1 at the end of the if here, then there might be something else live in R1 that then needs to be moved to R2 because we happen to put the fee node there. And then that has to happen in parallel. So what you'd have to do is create a fee node with like physical arguments and physical destination, or what do what Echo does and just keep SSA alive. So it's a bit tricky. You can't just insert copies blindly.
Yeah, so the algorithm Echo does is, it in principle, is just a very straightforward SSA repairing algorithm. What IR3 does is just basically repair the register, and IR3 just remembers the register, and Echo creates actual renames for the SSA values and repairs the SSA. Both have the same result and are in principle the same idea. It's just the question whether you want correct SSA after the register allocation or if you don't care anymore about SSA after register allocation. So I think that's it so far about the...
Do we want to go into more detail on the library and splitting and the whole loops versus ifs question?
So we didn't really... Here we only used a branch as an example, but it can also happen that you got a live range split.
We have the extra. We have this extra slide on live range split.
Yeah. It can happen that you have the live range split in a loop. So what happens then, Connor?
So let's go back. Wait, let's go back to this slide. And let's say that like instead of an if else there, we have like a loop. We have a while loop, and the R1 gets moved to R2 in some like live range split in the middle of the loop. So what ACO does, well, do you want to talk about what ACO used to do versus what it does now?
No, I think.
Within an if, you can just create vnodes on the fly, kind of, because once you visit a block, you've already visited all of its predecessors, and then you know what it got renamed to, but when you visit the header block of the loop, you might not have visited some of the predecessors before. So you sort of have to speculatively create vnodes, or at least record somehow, like, so pick a register based on the things that were already visited, record, oh, these are the live registers at the beginning of this block, and then do the entire thing, and then once you get to the end of the loop, you compare like what are the registers now with what were the registers at the beginning, and then either insert vnodes or just insert those like physical vnodes. And if you insert real vnodes like an ACO, then you have to go back through the entire loop and rewrite everything using that value back to the vnode.
Yeah, but let's just assume that we just insert the physical vnodes or whatever at the beginning of the loop. Keep in mind that the register is already fixed. Like when you first visited the loop and handled the live in values at the loop header, then every live in already has a register. So when you do a live range split in the loop, then it's clear that the vnode has this original register, and you only change the sources of the vnode. You cannot then pick a different register for your variable.
It's, after you visit the loop.
Yeah, after you visited the loop, it will stay, like, it must go back to the original register. That your live range split will be copied back by inserting the vnode at the beginning of the header.
But then it actually turns into a copy at the end of the loop after when you lower vnodes.
So, yeah, I hope this wasn't too complex now. What is this?
Oh, yeah, but talking about the details of how you do live range splitting. We glossed over that, but so in the original algorithm, we processed the uses and then processed the destination, and they were kind of separate in separate loops, and we didn't have to intermix them. But as soon as we get to live range splitting, that's no longer the case, and things are no longer so simple because they kind of now interact with each other. So you need to consider that there are three types of values that you care about. First, uses that are killed, and live through values, which includes uses which are not killed, which are basically treated the same as things that happen to be live through the instruction from the point of view of live range splitting. and then definitions. So the problem is, and one of the one way to sort of describe it in the puzzle allocation paper that Daniel mentioned is you can imagine a 2 by n puzzle board where the width of the puzzle board is 2 and the height is the size of your register file. Killed uses can only go on the left because they end in the middle, and so the width 2 represents the state of the register file beforehand, and then the left-hand side represents the state of the register file before your instruction. The right-hand side represents the state of the register file after your instruction. And then killed uses can only go on the left, and you have to fill all of them in. Definitions only go on the right because they're only live after the instruction, and you have to fill those in. And then live through values are live both before and after the instruction. So, and they have to be at the same value. You can't shuffle them during the instruction. So they have to be the same. And then you basically place these pieces on this puzzle board, and you want to find a solution to this puzzle which minimizes the number of killed uses and live through which differ from what they were before the instruction. And then after you solve this puzzle, then you, for everything that was different, for every killed use and live through that's different, you go and insert a parallel copy. And then those all have to happen at once because you basically decided the solution for your thing all at once. And then it has to be, the live values are live here and then they're there, but we all decided how they were, you have to kind of have decide where to put them at once. And then you insert this parallel copy instruction, and then the whole transfer graph thing takes care of actually turning it into hardware instructions.
Yeah, it sounded probably more complicated than it actually is. But in short, it's when you do the live ring splitting and you move variables around, you have to keep in mind that this might be an operand that is just killed, or it might be a definition, a second definition of your instruction, and you have to take care a bit where you can move it if it really already exists and at the point when you do the live ring split or if there's something else in the way, stuff like that. So
I think in IR3 we basically only support one definition per register file at the moment. And then the way it works is we keep the state of the register file beforehand.
You have the split instruction that has multiple definitions.
Oh, but ours doesn't, remember, because the whole register coalescing thing. I really wish it had multiple destinations. It would have made everything so much easier, but it does not. We keep the state of the register file beforehand, and also a split instruction is trivial because you can just always assign it to the same thing.
Yeah.
Because we only support destination, we just look at the register file before the instruction, and then we shuffle things around to make space for the destination, record everything, insert our parallel copy instruction, and then allocate our destination to the hole that we basically made in that register file. But that kind of doesn't work if there's multiple destinations, because you kind of need to make multiple holes and remember where the previous hole was so that you don't kind of fill it again, or at least move it around. And I think Aiko has a more complicated thing that can, in theory, handle multiple destinations.
Yeah.
Where you constantly switch back and forth to the state before and after the instruction.
But we block the register file to not move certain registers anymore. Anyways, I don't really dare to ask if there are questions about this topic.
This is one of the nastier parts of a real world SSA based allocator.
I wanted to talk with you about transitioning a existing classic register allocator to this SSA based style without actually using SSA. So But first, let me ask if there are questions about this live range splitting stuff.
I was wondering if there's any scope for, in some cases, just going back and changing the original allocation of that variable. But it sounds like that would be kind of rewinding and going a bit sort of taking the age of the universe.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this is where it becomes NP-hard real quick, because that's basically like a backtracking kind of thing.
Yeah. This is called recoloring. There's a paper about doing that in a graph-based fashion afterwards, doing recoloring, and they just limit the recursion depth to not make it immediately taking exponential time. But that's definitely that's, you directly hit into the NP hardness of the register location when you try that. In Aku, we currently are experimenting with some very simple recoloring approach by walking once after the register location, walking once over the program and just checking if the parallel copy can be coalesced with the original definition. Like, instead of making one definition and then immediately copying it away, just directly write to the second one.
You do that in a kind of tree scanny kind of way, or does it need more traditional liveness analysis and that sort of thing?
You can do some limited amount of it, but the problem is, in general, in order to do that, to move the definition and the parallel copy, you need to make sure that everything in between the definition and parallel copy doesn't interfere with it. In general, I think that bit requires building up an interference graph, which is exactly the thing we kind of wanted to avoid with the whole scanning approach.
Mm. Yeah. So if you don't do it recursively, then you are limited to very few cases where it actually works, that the register was already free. But if you want to do it extensively, you are immediately in the NP-hard graph coloring situation.
Yeah, so all register allocators have some kind of like problem where stuff winds up blowing up, and you're like, oh, if only it could have done this. And then this is kind of the area where it happens with SSA-based allocators. There are so many different ways where you can be like, oh, but if only it did this, then run into NP hardness.
Yeah, we call this the RA lottery in Aco.
I think every driver has
every register allocator has an RA lottery.
I guess your point at the start of your talk yesterday was that on a GPU where spills are really expensive, it's worth doing something that might have extra copies just to get rid of all the spills.
Yeah. That's the theory, at least.
Yeah, that's exactly what we do. So Aco does spilling before the register allocation, even before scheduling, so that the spill decisions can be scheduled as well. That's part of the idea. And it doesn't even call the spilling pass if we know that we have enough registers for the program. And so spilling happens in Aco basically in 1 in 1,000 shaders only. So we really broadly avoid spilling at all if we can avoid it. And only if the program already, like without scheduling, needs too many registers, then we only consider spilling as an option.
We are, however, experimenting with trying to spill some stuff if it can give us a bigger number of waves for the shader.
Yeah.
So if you can reduce your register usage by a couple of registers and that gives you more parallelism, then it might be worth it. I think Daniel had some promising patches for that.
Yeah, we need more benchmarking to see if that actually helps.
Where is that patch, by the way? Because I'd be interested to take a look at that.
Yeah, I can. I think I have that somewhere. I will paste it to you afterwards.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, is there more questions about it? Otherwise, I think we don't have too much time anymore. So I would like to get into the transition of the.
So I think doing spilling ahead of time, is that how IR3 works as well? Does it do spilling ahead of RA?
Yes, it also does spilling, and it is using the exact same paper that ACO is using. We didn't have any time at all to go over the spilling algorithm. I don't know if we can make it in vaporize that out of thin air, but actually the spilling is better because there is a real paper that explains how the spilling happens. So it's a less bad situation than, for example, live range splitting, where there's just nothing. There's just our presentation as far as we know, and a bunch of kind of half-baked ideas in papers.
I would really, really like to do it ahead of time for our stuff because when you do it post-RA or mid-RA, I guess, due to all of our crazy striding stuff, there's a bunch of cases where you have to like unspill and then respill just to get at weirdly strided things. But if we did pre-RA spilling and we were a little bit more judicious about where we picked our spills, we could almost always spill logical values instead of physical values. And that would allow us to take much better advantage of the spill fill instructions that we have available to us.
I think so. The problem with that is that on Intel, like, because you have these like values that are live and then values that are sort of live, the values that are sort of live can share the same register, and they can share a register with the actually live values. That means that you don't have that same strict, you don't have that like condition which kind of guarantees that allocation is always going to succeed.
I think we can get there if we have the right interference model. It's just a matter of how absurdly painful it's going to end up being.
I think I think you need some sort of approximation. The one we were talking about is just like in uniform flow, control flow, you can ignore all this, but then in each, you divvy up each of the regions, the outermost like non-uniform regions, and then you figure out like, okay, how many 16-bit values are there? How many 32-bit values do you need? How many scalar values do you need? And then just add them up.
Yeah, the maximum of each.
And then divvy it, kind of partition it statically between them.
Yeah, I mean, we could still compute a pressure in terms of bytes where we keep track of all of the sort of live, I don't know what you would call them, but the sort of ephemeral stuff that's live in other channels that are disabled as also being contributing to that number of bytes or something. I think
but then the problem is that they can overlap, so you will also overestimate things. And
I think we just have to eat that. Like, there's some amount of overestimating that we're just going to have to suck it up and eat.
So either you can overestimate it by like statically partitioning the file and just like assuming that you don't, the case where you would overestimate there is where you have like a lot of 16-bit values live and then later you have a lot of 32-bit values live, and that kind of overestimates it in that case, but then at least allows you to overlap these ephemeral registers, versus that case is basically the same as your overestimates thing, what you just said basically overestimates things in the same way that your current register allocator overestimates things.
Let me quickly go over the idea of transitioning an existing classic register allocator to this SSA-based approach. So this idea is based on the fact that if you lower SSA, or if you deconstruct SSA, your register pressure does not yet change as long as you insert parallel copies instead of a sequence of copies. So by just translating out of SSA and inserting parallel copies at the control flow edges, if you have no critical edges, at least, I think that doesn't work even if you have critical edges. So yeah, by just inserting the parallel copies at the control flow edges, you don't change your register pressure. So the assumptions that just with getting away with live range splitting instead of spilling still holds.
And if you think about the, actually when I was coding this up in IR3, I even noticed this, that the handling for live range splits and the handling for fee nodes, the handling for live range, like re-merging live range splits and the handling for fee nodes is actually surprisingly very similar. Because in both cases, you have to kind of like and insert these copies along the edges. And so you could, in theory, get rid of the fee nodes and just use your live range splitting code.
Yeah. And so the idea would be to deconstruct SSA, but keep the parallel copies in place, and then add live range splitting to your register allocator. Your register allocator can still keep the ability to spill code, but you can already implement the logic behind live range splitting and fixing up the live range splits. And then you can transition from there by special casing the parallel copies at the end of the blocks, because now it becomes important that you basically handle them as if they are fee nodes in the next block. So instead of already allocating the parallel copy definitions when you finish a block, you can handle the definitions of the parallel copy when you are actually handling the live ins in the next block. But I think there's a path forward to basically smoothly transition from a classic allocator to such SSA-based, to the SSA-based ideas at least, without interrupting or completely rewriting the register allocator, because that's a ton of work and we will start with a lot of bugs, and then you will have to write a register allocation validator, which you should do if you didn't already anyways.
So both ICO and IR3 have this like validation pass, which is a really nice thing because it catches all of your tricky RA bugs, and it gives you if it didn't fail, it gives you the guarantee that your RA is not the source of a bug, some like kind of miscompilation or something. And the way it works is basically just by following each definition from its use and making sure that register kind of gets there from the definition all the way to the use without getting clobbered. At least in IR3's case, we do it as like a data flow analysis.
We also resort to some kind of live variable analysis and check that basically that all the properties hold and the register file is only used by a single variable during its lifetime.
You were talking about converting register allocators, and there's actually a really good paper on this. It's called Quality and Speed in Linear Scan Register Allocation. And I believe it's by some people at Harvard. And it's one of the ones that I dug up when I was working on IBC. And it basically does a SSA based linear scan register allocator without actually going into SSA. By using a lot of the same concepts and kind of inserting fee nodes and shuffling stuff around as needed across edges. I can provide
swap instructions and stuff like parallel. Does it insert parallel copies?
It's not the same. I don't remember if they used a parallel copy or not. I think they may have had to in some cases.
Is this the one describing the LVM allocator?
No.
Because I know LVM does do some live range splitting, but then they kind of run into the same sort of problems we were describing where like they try to like backtrack and stuff and then it can kind of blow up in your face. Live range split.
Anyway, I'll post a citation to the paper. In case anybody's interested. I found it to be an interesting read.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't have time to scan the paper now, so I'll just keep a tab open. Does anyone want to talk about specifically IR3 and its, I think we have another 30 minutes or so. Starts at
35,
it's 2 hours.
Just before that, can I just ask about the transitioning thing? Does anyone know of anyone working on doing that sort of thing to introduce this kind of register allocation on the LLVM target independent code generator?
I don't know of that, honestly. I think someone might have done it for x86, but...
SSA-based register allocator?
Yeah, LLVM, like... the thing about register allocators is that the design of the register, like the more complex your register allocator becomes, the more the design of the IR becomes tied to the design of the register allocator. And actually, you can remember someone mentioning this on LLVM Dev that like the design of the IR and the design of the register allocator kind of become intertwined. To rewrite IR3 to use SSA-based register allocation, I had to change a number of things in the IR. So I imagine that if you were to do that with LVM, it would be basically rewriting everything.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's quite difficult to figure out how you would fit it into its existing framework of, in theory, pluggable register allocators, but they all rely on how MIR works and how live intervals work.
Exactly. Yeah. So the data structures kind of become intertwined. It's nice in theory that you can like plug in different register allocators. I don't really think it works in practice.
There's a lot of restrictions on instructions or what you allow in your IR and then how your register allocator has to deal with that. I mean, all these restrictions on instructions have to be handled by the register allocator.
So in LLVM, you kind of just build up this like register file and describe all the constraints very like mechanically. But with live range splitting, you kind of can't do that because the particular constraints impacts the algorithm that you have to use to solve the puzzle, so to speak. And so you kind of can't write your live range splitting algorithm without knowing a bit about the structure of the register file.
Yeah. So, I mean, does that result in a compiler like ACO that means that if you one day wanted to retarget it to something else, like, say, Intel GPUs, then you would have to sort of half rewrite all that stuff?
Yeah. I mean, Connor, I think he would have loved to just copy it over, but that
didn't really work out. That ties in again to the question I got during the talk of, like, and I think Anhold asked the same question initially when I first mentioned this of like, can we share this? And like, there's shared infrastructure in LLVM, there's a shared register allocator thingy in Mesa, but it just becomes so much harder with SSA-based register allocation.
I suggested to Connor that he should just extend the Echo IR with IR3 instructions.
So
but that would basically be rewriting LLVM inside Mesa, right? So that's a bit of that.
And run into the same problems of like your live range splitting being heavily dependent on what your register file looks like.
I can tell that even in Echo, so we have some GPU generations that support a swap instruction and some older GPU generations that don't do that. And also in SGPRs, there's no swap instruction. And this already affects how the register allocator tries to search for available registers and live range splits, because if there is a swap instruction, then it's actually beneficial to reuse the swapped away position of a variable, because then with a single instruction you can just swap two places. But if you don't have a swap instruction, then you want to avoid this case, because then you end up with three instructions instead of two if you use any other position. So that this is just a very small example how your architecture affects the live range splitting algorithm.
And if I hadn't accidentally discovered the swap instruction on Qualcomm, I probably would have done stuff a little differently too. I would have had to do this whole liveness like scanning thing. You do kind of have to work on your architecture a bit, I think, if you want to use this sort of algorithm. Like, you can't, it brings a lot of benefits for GPUs, and it makes things so much better. But you can't just use it with any architecture. It's not pluggable in that sense.
Is there a swap instruction on Intel, actually?
No.
Oh, okay.
Lack of a swap instruction is the least of our problems.
That's kind of true.
Like, there are when it comes to thinking about things like SSA based register allocation, our GPU architecture is pathological. There's a lot of problems that we need to solve before we can get there that fall into the category of academic research. The lack of a swap instruction is, I mean, sure, I'd love a swap instruction, but oh boy.
Yeah. I kind of wonder when the architects add these swap instructions, is it because they're reading these like SSA-based register allocation papers? Like, I can't imagine any other reason why. Like,
swapping data around is a fairly common thing.
But even in LLVM, I don't think they have any like optimization. Maybe they have some people somewhere that try to detect that pattern and turn it into a swap instruction.
I mean, it's hard to represent a swap instruction in SSA. So it's probably not going to be represented in LLVM directly, but like you could peephole to generate it potentially.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know.
This is a parallel copy.
Maybe they just look at CPUs and CPUs have swap instructions. So like, this seems like a good idea. I don't know.
True. If you have SSA with only single definitions, you cannot represent the swap instruction.
Well, it gets folded into the parallel copy in the FeeNode, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a parallel copy, but that has multiple definitions.
Well, that's one of the other reasons why I don't know how it would even work on Intel, is that the way our hardware is set up, it's very clearly separated between source and destination, and I'm not a swap instruction would have to be a completely different encoding, effectively.
And actually, on Qualcomm, the same thing happened, and they did just define a completely different category of instruction, where like you have multiple sources and destinations.
I think AMD just writes one of the sources.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now that we've got, now that with Tiger Lake we've got the scoreboard based dependency tracking, swap is probably possible to stick into the hardware. I don't think it would have been possible before without Insanity. But yeah, it's, again, swap is the least of our problems.
So what we discussed about Intel earlier today was that the idea to basically statically partition the register file, I think Connor mentioned that already. Yeah, and then handle it as a couple of independent register files, at least within control flow.
So. Yeah, and then you're gonna have these like live values and then these like ephemeral live values, whatever you want to call them. And then you probably want to insert fee notes for them on loops and stuff like that when they're like, you know, the loop is, what's the case where the loop is divergent and there can be cases where it's like live in the beginning of the loop, but only in inactive lanes because it represents the previous iterations that already ended and have the value waiting for after the loop. But so you want to basically construct that, like if those ephemeral sort of live ranges, and then you probably want to either statically partition or come up with something more clever. And then you want to insert vnodes and copies for those ephemeral edges the same as normal edges, only you use nomads construction when you actually go and like insert the copies and swaps.
Statically partitioning potentially works.
The problem with this, the partitioning, is that again, like similar to what I mentioned with the problem with pre-coloring, like if your static partition is kind of scattered, then you have problems. So maybe what you want to do is like have a way to change the partitioning, kind of where you just use nomask instructions to move everything around and keep track of that.
We could sort of we have the nomask instructions, so we can rearrange the partitioning if needed.
And rearrange all of the ephemeral values while you're at it, and then so you're probably gonna need to do something like that, unless you have a static partitioning and it's like not at all mixed, so that it's like one type and then the other type and then the other type.
And doing the static partitioning for scalar/uniform values versus vector values would not be too hard. We just figure out what our scalar register pressure is and put all that stuff at the beginning.
It's an overestimation, but I think it's not, it's still,
it shouldn't be a terrible overestimation.
Yeah, I mean, what's the alternative? To spill as soon as you don't find a register?
I guess the alternative is to just assume that the ephemeral values are actually live, which is kind of what the existing allocator does.
But that's also an overestimation.
Add holes to the file.
But the problem is that that's not the only case we have to worry about, because we have different size values, and we can have, you know, ghost interference. Let's call them ghost values. I like that better, because then they haunt you and they're kind of alive. We've got ghost values that where depending on your stride you might land on top of them. We can have like 16-bit registers with a 2-byte stride, we can have 16-bit registers with a 4-byte stride, and those can interfere with each other. We can have 32-bit registers interfering with 16-bit registers. We can have, if you have two 32-bit registers where they don't start at the same spot, then you can have the channel masks not line up. Like the number of cases where this can go off the rails is massive.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think of like the data structure you use inside a basic block, because that's kind of simpler than an intra-basic block. That's a whole nother can of worms. But I think the data structure you use inside a basic block is something like, for each register, in addition to keeping track of which live values it is, you keep track of which ghost values it has, and you keep track of the stride and quarter of that register, meaning like the ghost values and live values, like which stride do they use, which quarter do they use.
Right. So
and they have to be always, the rule is that they have to always be the same, either a scalar or stride of one or stride of two or whatever.
Yeah, I've written this data structure. I've written a linear scan register allocator.
But that, yeah, so the difference is the linear scan is that thing for each register over the entire, that thing for each live value. But for this, you want to do that for each register as you scan along.
Yeah, so the data structure that I had basically tracked per byte and had a pointer.
I think that's a bit of overkill. You can probably do it per vec 8, I think.
But scalars, we have to deal with scalars, and those can be a single
byte.
Yeah,
well, but then you have a scalar type where, like, this vec 8 is full of stuff.
Right. So you can compress it down that way. But
yeah.
At the end of the day, you end up having to track like all of the things that are basically the way I did it was I didn't allow things to overlap if they didn't have matching stride patterns. And so that means you can't absolutely calculate pressure.
How many of these stride patterns do you actually have then in total?
So there's one possible pattern for 64-bit values, two for 32, four for 16.
And how many are allowed to overlap? I mean, how many conflicting patterns do you have?
They all conflict with each other, right?
Basically what it comes down to is that I should back up. I have more stride patterns than that because you have a stride, and anything with the same stride and the same start is fine. So if you insist that everything is aligned to, is aligned the right way, then you can get rid of the multiplicity from the phase. But you, as long as the phase matches and the stride matches, you're good to go because you can have like, if you have like a 4-byte strided 16-bit value and a 4-byte strided 32-bit value, those can interfere nicely as long as they start at the same spot. You can have some things that work nicely together, but the vast majority of your 16-bit values are going to be 2-byte strided, not 4-byte.
I think what
yeah,
you want
I was
going to
say,
is...
do you really need all those? Like, we need 4-byte
stride. Maybe what you do is, so you have a structure that represents, like, what is the, you divvy the first 64 bits of each VEC8 into bytes, and then you say, which value is at this byte, and what stride is the overall VEC8
yeah. at? Coming up with the data structure to store the information is tedious, but it's not an especially hard problem. The bigger question is if we get to the end and we have to insert fees to resolve the mess.
I think that should be a huge
how much
problem.
Pain is that going to be? Because
I think that should be a huge problem. As long as you assume that I think that ghost values that are together kind of stick together, then you either have these like regular fees, which follow the mask, and then you insert parallel copy instructions that follow the mask, or they're like ghost fees, and then you have to insert no mask instructions. You can either move around just the active parts of a value, or move around like all of them.
But there's going to be other problems like. So the problem, the potential solution we were talking about to the pathological, what happens if the two ends of my vector are on opposite ends of the register file case, where you split stuff up. I think we will actually have to solve that problem because you can end up, because everything is strided, you can end up with a case where you have enough bytes for a value, but they're in weird places and they're not in a consistent stride that you can use. And so you end up having to like maybe restride something.
Yeah.
So like if our entire register file is full of 16-bit values with 4-byte strides, and suddenly we need a 32-bit value with an 8-byte stride, which is a thing that could happen, then we have enough bytes, but the only way we can get at it is if we start repacking some of those 16-bit values to have a 2-byte stride.
Yeah, I think that cannot happen if you statically partition the register file, right?
Yeah, if you can get away with a static partition, all the problems go away. It's just a matter of whether or not static partitioning actually works. And we have enough variation in the different strides, especially if you... So if it's a usual GL shader that only deals with 32-bit floats, there are no problems. Everything has a 4-byte stride. We don't...
I think maybe you can assume... Maybe don't assume a static stride, but assume that there's still a dynamic partition that at each point in the register file, like it's either assigned to something with a 16-bit stride or a 32-bit stride.
You can't do pre-RA spilling without figuring out that partitioning ahead of time, which maybe that's what you do. Maybe you figure out the partition as a first pass.
Yeah, it's what I thought. And the partition can change outside control flow, but it cannot change inside control flow. And then it's only question of how much do you overestimate your register pressure doing that, and if it's still worth it or not, because then you might have to spill more than actually necessary, but I cannot imagine that it's really, that the impact is huge, but that's something to test. I mean, you can also calculate this partitioning or the theoretical register pressure with static partitioning and see how far you are away and how much more you spill currently versus you would spill then. That I will and run some shader database and just calculate the difference between the theoretical spilling using a static partition and the current spilling.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned with doing that simply because our current shader databases that we have right now don't have a lot of stuff that uses 64-bit types or 8 and 16-bit types. And I don't want to, like, I don't want to end up designing something that is pathological in those cases.
You probably just need more Android games then. Just get lots of stuff using Medium P.
I think we have a big ton of Vulkan pipelines. I have to ask though.
Always have stuff.
I think there's some exploration that we can do there, and maybe static partitioning is good enough. In most cases, if all you have is 16 and 32-bit types, then you're only really going to end up with two vector partitions. You're going to have the 4-byte stride and the 2-byte stride.
And the uniforms.
And the uniforms, yeah.
How horrible would it be to just... pick the sort of physical stride layout of 16-bit values and then just fix that as a pre-pass and then assume that you only have one or the other and you're not converting between them on the fly in RA? Or if you need to convert between them, just insert those before you do RA?
Unfortunately, due to region restrictions, that's a pain in the neck. Because destinations have to be strided out to at least as big as the source stride. And so anytime you like read the bottom 32 bits of the bottom 16 bits of a 32 bit value, the destination of that has to have a stride of 4 bytes. But then there's cases where you can't have a stride of 4 bytes.
Like, how does like extracting the low 16 bits of a 32-bit value like in the NUR instruction work then?
We end up generating an instruction that has a strided destination where it's strided out to 4 bytes, but it's a 16-bit type.
And then you just can't pack it like you just have to use 4-byte stride everywhere? Like,
But there's places we can't use 4-byte stride. So we have to insert it from. Like we have to insert moves to stride stuff out and pack stuff again sometimes.
Okay, so you can do it with a move, but like not with anything else?
Yeah, so moves are allowed to break a lot of rules. So moves are allowed to compact things.
Okay. But then you might be kind of screwed if you need to swap things.
We can't do it with XOR.
Yeah, you might need to think that through carefully.
But I think like the copies can only happen within the same stride restrictions.
Yeah, so you have to make sure when you insert your parallel copy instruction that all of your strides match. And if you don't have a matching stride somewhere, then you have to insert extra moves either at the source of the parallel copy or at the destination to repack things appropriately.
So,
and this is where I was talking about how like it's nice when you have one pass that just like does all of the insanity like in the parallel copy instruction. So if there is a way to do it, like just do some crazy sequence of instructions in the parallel copy implementation, and then you can try to avoid it in the rest of it, but then at least it's that's kind of contained.
I mean it might be possible, but I think you might be able to back yourself into a corner where you absolutely have to do a swap across strides. And I don't know if that's, I don't think XOR allows that.
I mean, I don't know.
But if you can detect, like if you can run a sort of simulated parallel copy lowering and detect that that's the case, you can like insert some extra moves to deal
with. But the thing is that inserting the extra move is the same as resolving a parallel copy. So the problem is that you probably run out of registers, right?
You can always keep one extra register. That's not an issue.
So yeah, we could reserve a register, in which case all is solved because I can do a swap with 3 moves and an extra register.
And yeah, and then you don't, and all of, you can do whatever crazy parallel copy you want and then just use this extra register to resolve.
The extra register just has to be big enough to store the maximum size swap I'll ever need.
Is that the case, actually? Can you do one?
Actually, can you do like a scalar XOR instruction?
But I might not want to swap the ghost channels.
Oh yeah, that's right.
I would have to think about that. It might be possible with like 4 or 5 XOR instructions and appropriate passing to make that happen.
This is where it gets really like hairy, and at least that's all self-contained. I had to go through a similar sort of thing in IR3 where the 16-bit register in 16-bit mode, you can only access the lower half of the register file. But then sometimes in the parallel copy lowering code, you can generate you have to generate swaps or moves that involve the upper half of the file as a 16-bit register. And then you just have to suck it up and like insert extra instructions in that case. If everything just works, you can kind of avoid having to deal with it in the rest of register allocation.
Do you know what our worst case was on old hardware to pack multiple bytes in one register if the source is the same byte? Like just duplicating the same byte in one register. And now we do some multiply by some crazy magic number to replicate the bytes in the register. But that's all contained in the lowering of parallel copies stuff. So
I think we could improve that by using byte per mute, by the way.
Yeah, on GFX 6, I don't think there's...
Well, not 6, of course, but 8 and above.
I think it's, what he meant is it's only on 6 where you do that.
Yeah,
it's crazy stuff. So there winds up being all sorts of hardware insanity that the parallel copy lowering generally has to deal with. And that's just kind of the way it is. There's the library splitting, which depends on your register file, and then there's the parallel copy lowering, which also heavily depends on what instructions you have. And you, in the end, like those two parts kind of suck, but then the rest of it is very simple. And the at least the hardware insanity is contained in those two parts.
Yeah. Is there more questions about general SSA-based register allocation stuff?
Because any questions about the? We never managed to cover the register sharing thing that I do in IR3. Variables and the values in the same register.
Stacking the same value on in the same register slot, if you know that's the same value, basically.
Which is this whole other thing, which is kind of forced upon me by IR3 not having like the wrong split instruction. So I think we're getting towards the end.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question that's unrelated to that? This is an ACO specific question. That you know when you have whole wave mode and on the LLVM backend we have to dedicate a small number of registers to whole wave mode use. So they're VGPRs, but they're used in whole wave mode for reductions and stuff. And Connor, I think you might have done that fix originally. I can't remember. Is there a better way of handling that with this kind of register allocation?
So you would have a lot of fun with Jason because this is exactly the same problem. but the way it works in ACO is just you have this linear GPR. It's basically reserving a register, but a little smarter.
Because there's two things. We have the linear control flow graph and the logical control flow graph, if you remember from earlier. And we just pretend that there's a VGPR, which normally are only live in the logical control flow graph. And we say that this one, then we call it the linear VGPR, is live in the linear control flow graph. And what we additionally do is that we take care that the life range, so that when this variable is created and when it's not needed anymore, that this only goes from outside control flow to, again, outside control flow. And this way we can dynamically allocate a VGPR and dynamically give it away again, while LLVM has to basically reserve it from
the whole program.
The whole program.
So we are reserving it, but inside each non-uniform region separately.
Okay,
So I don't think you can get much better than that without dealing with all of the insanity that was just talking about.
The cool thing, though, is that we can also reuse the same concept for spilling SGPRs to VGPRs. So we do the same trick, basically, if we want to spill some SGPRs, and we can spill them to a VGPR by also allocating a single VGPR for that region and use it there, and then we free it up again afterwards. So
yeah, I think LLVM again does that for the whole function.
I mean, it's better than the state it was before in that was just broken.
Yes.
So. Yeah, and I think the overhead of allocating it for the whole program is pretty small, because normally you are tied in registers in this region where you allocate it anyway, and you don't really need that register afterwards, so freeing it up doesn't give you much of a benefit anyways. So I think the difference is really small in this case. And you could also see that when LVM fixed that up, that, for example, the performance in the Doom 2016 game increased by like 20%. So and got close to what we achieved. So there isn't really much of a difference anymore by allocating it for the whole program.
Mm. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, if there are no more questions, then I'd also just say thank you for showing up, everyone.
Oh, and if I think there were still people were still a little confused and when we were doing IR3 register allocation. If anyone has any questions and wants to go through the code, probably now this week is the time. But yeah, you can always create a separate room afterwards. I know this is a really complicated topic. Certainly not simple to write.
You can also just ping us afterwards if you realize you had another question, or if just something came to mind, or if you were just shy to ask.
So I kind of went through a little bit of it the other day in sorting out that RA validate bug. It kind of helps just to like have something to debug and force yourself to go through it.
Yeah, definitely. All right, I think that's it.
Yeah.
Sorry, can I ask something else? Tim, is there a way to reach you on IRC?
No, sorry. I could give you my email if you want. I'm on IRC at the moment, but I'm not generally on there.
Oh, okay. What's your nickname? I will just ping you there, and
okay, yeah,
you can give me your email.
I'm on as NPHCT.
Oh, okay.
So the initials of nice piping hot cup of tea.
Sorry, NPHCT. Okay, got it. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay, then I think that's all for today's workshops. Connor, Daniel, and everyone who was here today, thanks for coming, and see you tomorrow.
Okay.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Have a nice day.